Thank you. And 908, I was trying to figure out when our insurance came up. I think it's the end of the year. It always goes up every year, and the benefits sometimes change. And it's going to be a problematic 2026, I think, for a lot of people. Sean Greminger, tell me, Sean, I'm sorry.
It's Greminger.
Sean Greminger joins us, President and CEO of the National Alliance of Healthcare Purchaser Coalitions. Talk about employee healthcare insurance costs and how much they could jump in 2026. Thanks for taking the time with us, and good morning.
Thanks, Tommy. Great to be here.
They never come down, do they?
They never do. Unfortunately, it feels like we're on a never-ending escalator.
So, because every year when ours comes out, you realize another year is gone. And look, I'm not criticizing anything. I'm thankful that we have it. It just always does go up, and then the deductible this or that, the other thing.
Yeah.
How do you come about, how do you go about determining an average? Who are the major healthcare providers? I guess maybe I'm trying to break this down, Sean, in ways that are understandable on the radio. How do you go about determining an average for employee healthcare costs? Are there just certain big companies like ours as UMR that provide the coverage?
Yeah, there are, and I'll say so much of the cost of annual premium, it's really about the input costs, right? So it's what are the healthcare providers and others charging that ultimately get translated into what your premium is, and that's a product of a couple things. Hospitals and hospital prices are roughly 50% of overall healthcare costs for most employer health plans, but then you can add in a lot of other things, so the outpatient services and of course the cost of prescription drugs, which continue to rise.
So when it comes to choices that companies have for providing, because I'm sure that Odyssey, the company we work for, shops around. They want to get the best deal for all of the employees that they possibly can. How competitive is the market when it comes to big corporations that are seeking insurance for their employees and the big corporations that provide the insurance?
Yeah, and that's actually really one of the big problems in healthcare in the United States, is that there isn't a lot of competition left. And we've seen a lot of consolidation over the last 20 years or so, which is part of what's driving high and rising healthcare costs. So it starts with hospital systems. In Louisiana, you really only have two or three kind of large hospital systems that the insurers have to negotiate with. And then you look at, on the insurance side, there's only, two or three large insurance plans in Louisiana. So if you're an employer and you're trying to figure out how you can get the best access at the most reasonable cost, you don't have that many choices of insurance plans, and those insurance plans don't have a lot of choices between hospitals and health systems, which means that, these large corporations continue to jack up their prices, and there's not a whole lot, day to day that an employee or even an employer can do.
So health insurance is state to state, and that take me through this, because I don't understand. Sean, you look, I have no earthly idea. They sent me the bill. It's like, okay, sure, whatever, why not? I believe you. I got to take your word for it, because there's no way I can argue whether I owe it to you or not, or the copay. Co-insurance is not insurance. It's what I'm paying. I don't know why they call that co-insurance. And there's no insurance company involved. I don't understand what the difference between co-insurance and a copay is, because either way, it's coming out of my pocket, right?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. So, health insurance, it depends on the type of insurance, but it's either regulated at the state level, or in some cases it's regulated at the federal level. Mm-hmm. But in the end, most of the time you can have an insurance plan that's in your state, right? So you'd have, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Louisiana, or, the kind of Cigna or United Healthcare plan in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And then they're negotiating with the local providers, right? So, Ochsner or LCMC. And then, of course, all of the docs. So it's even though the regulation sometimes is in D.C., sometimes is in the state, the market is very local and it's localized. That's why we see actually pretty big variation between healthcare costs in one state versus another, because it just depends on the local market dynamics.
So you got company XYZ located in Baltimore. And they mm-hmm. have employees all over in all 50 states, and they try to get an insurance plan for them.
Mm-hmm.
Who negotiates with whom? Because when you mentioned independent doctors, I can't believe that. I don't know if there's an association of doctors that negotiates with insurance companies. How does all of that work?
Yeah, it's a great question. So when you have a large multi-state employer, That would be what's called an ERISA plan. You don't have to worry about the title, but mm-hmm. that's going to be a plan where the company is, the regulation is, happens in D.C. because it's a national plan, mm-hmm. and that company will say, all right, I'm going to contract with United Health Group, right? Might be a big one, because they have a network all over the country. And then United is individually negotiating with every health system in a particular area, and then they're kind of negotiating with doctors, but more often what they do is they tend to just say, look, here's the price that we're willing to pay for this service, and they try to recruit as many doctors into that network as possible, and if the price is too low, they bring the price up until they have kind of enough doctors in any particular specialty or any particular area, and that's the network that you then have to live with.
I don't mean to get too far in the weeds, but as I always say, if you played golf for money, you know that's where most of the cheating takes place, in the weeds. When it comes to these companies, I guess that would be like a mass mailing that they send out to doctors, and they list procedures or codes or whatever, and they say, this is what we're willing to reimburse. Do you want in or not?
Yeah, that's basically it. Because as you said, they're not gonna go by, you know, Dr. Smith and then Dr. Jones and then Dr. Nguyen, right? They're gonna just say, here's kind of the prices, and do you want in or not? And then you know, the doctor has to decide whether they want in and whether they're willing to accept not only the payment rate but sort of all the contracting terms around that. And you know, that's an interesting challenge for doctors, because they feel like in many cases they're sort of on the receiving end of, mm-hmm. you know, an offer by a gigantic corporation that they don't really have access to, and they have to make a choice.
Speaking of receiving ends of offers from gigantic corporations, what led to all of the consolidation that we have?
You know, it's interesting, but kind of different sides blame each other. So mm-hmm. the hospitals will say, well, we've had to consolidate because we're negotiating up against, you know, these big insurance plans, right? Whether it's Blue Cross Blue Shield or United or anybody else. And the only way we could possibly keep up is if we consolidate. And then the insurance companies will sort of blame the hospitals and say, well, you know, it used to be that in Louisiana, you might have 10 different hospital systems, you know, each had their own kind of, you know, one or two hospitals. And now you're down to just a couple. And so the only way we can possibly negotiate with those guys is by getting, consolidated ourselves. So it's been sort of a consolidation war between the multiple sides. And, you know, unfortunately, I don't know who's at fault, but unfortunately, the people who are sort of paying for it are employers like the people that I represent and their employees, because as you said at the very beginning, you know, we're all paying 10-15% more year over year over year, and there's very little, you know, there's very little relief in sight.
So let me ask you this, since you did say 10-15%, what is 2026 looking like and why?
Yeah, it's looking bad. So we're going to see, you know, over the next couple of months, we're going to see some of the new rate notices come out. 15% is looking pretty typical this year, which is really high, even higher than what we've seen in the last couple of years. It's funny, we saw, you know, unlike everything else in the United States, where we saw a lot of inflation around the pandemic, in healthcare it actually was the opposite, because mm-hmm. people kind of stopped going to the doctor for a while during the pandemic. And so for the first time in a couple decades, we actually saw healthcare costs increase slower than the rest of the economy. But that's very much changed, and we're now back to sort of making up for lost time. So, you know, I'm hearing from a lot of employers that say, you know, 15-20% is typical. And then in the end, the employer then has to decide, you know, how much is the employer going to pay for, and how much are they going to expect their employees and their families to pay for? And that's where you get to your premiums, your mm-hmm. co-pays, your co-insurance, all of which is just out-of-pocket costs to working families.
So when it comes to your organization, tell me about the National Alliance of Healthcare Purchaser Coalitions. What is it that you do?
So we're a trade association. We're based here in Washington, D.C., and we actually represent regional employer purchaser coalitions, where employers in a specific area get together and they try to work together to solve some of these problems. So in Louisiana, we're proud to represent the Employer Coalition of Louisiana, based mm-hmm. out of Baton Rouge. And they themselves represent companies, right? So everything from, you know, large Fortune 500 companies all the way down to kind of smaller, you know, 100, 200 person companies, and also a lot of public purchasers. So like, you know, an individual parish that might be providing health care for all of its employees, et cetera. Our goal is to try to help employers get better deals, right? And to make sure that they are actually able to provide decent health care for their employees at a reasonable cost.
How does a company even go about, you know, I just, and again, I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but I don't know how you can determine. Are there algorithms or something that companies use to determine what gives them the most bang for the buck for what employees? Is it based on previous year's claims?
Yeah, actually, that's exactly right. A lot of times you're looking at previous year's claims, so you can get a sense of, like, you know, is my population healthier or less healthy than you know, another company? And then you kind of, usually you'll hire a consultant, and you go out to bid, right? You go out and you ask for, you know, you ask for the various different insurance companies to say, all right, how much will it cost for you to cover this or cover that? One of the things we're encouraging employers to do is to try to be a little bit more competitive and say, you know, instead of, you know, planning to contract with all three of the big systems in Louisiana, maybe you should look and see who are the most expensive ones and then say, we're not going to leave you in our network anymore. We're going to actually force you to become price competitive. And that's a real shift, because to date, most of the time, a lot of companies say, look, I just want the biggest network because I don't want to upset anybody and I want to make sure all my employees have access. Mm-hmm. And we're sort of encouraging to say, look, yeah, everybody wants to make sure they can go see their own doctor, but they're also tired of paying, you know, 20% more every year in their mm-hmm. coinsurance. Maybe you need to say, look, this hospital is overpriced, and we're not going to have you in our network anymore, with the hope that the following year, maybe they'll actually bring the prices down.
Meanwhile, the company's got to be loyal to the stockholders and the way the company's run, and in terms of compensation, they got to factor in that into as well as anticipated profits, right? I'm not trying to get in over my head here. I'm just trying to explain to people why their insurance premiums go up and what the company's up against as well.
Yeah, that's right. This is one of the big challenges when I talk to employers, which I do every day. I sort of say, what's motivating you? And it's really kind of two things. You know, it's one, you know, the CEOs and their stockholders are saying, like, God, why, you know, we're paying $25,000 a year to insure a family. Like, mm-hmm. this is crazy. You got to do something about it. And then on the other hand, the head of human resources is saying, yeah, but, you know, you want to make sure that we continue to attract and retain good employees. And the first thing that people ask, usually when they get a job after salary, the next thing they say is, well, tell me about my health benefits, mm-hmm. right? And if you sort of say, look, the salary is okay, but the benefits, you know, are kind of crappy, like, that doesn't usually go over very well. So they're really, in many ways, employers feel like they're stuck between a rock and a hard place.
I used to ask about vacation right after I got the job, and then I learned that's not the best thing to do, or sick leave policy, or how do you verify if I'm really sick or not? No, I'm just kidding. When it comes to the premiums that we pay from the employee side, we always say, up 15%. Do you have does your organization know how much an average company pays per individual for insurance? Because they pay half of it, they pay most of it. How does that work, generally speaking, proportionally? Do you know?
Yeah, it depends on the employer a lot. But I would say on average, it's about the company is actually paying for 75 or 80% of your total cost. So when you have a, you know, you may have a good sized deductible, you've got your premiums, you've got your coinsurance, all that stuff. It's really frustrating, right? Because you feel like, well, I've got this insurance, why is it not paying for anything? But when you look at what the company is picking up, it's often, you know, three or four times that much, which is why, you know, you've heard when people get laid off, maybe they have something called COBRA, which is sort of, you get to keep your health insurance for a while. but then you have to pay for your COBRA premium, and it's an enormous number. Well, your COBRA premium is based on the total amount that your employer was paying. So when a person gets their COBRA, they say, God, this is so expensive. Well, that's actually how much your company has been paying this whole time. And on average, you know, it's now over $25,000 a year just to cover a single family.
So it's the worst of both worlds. You lose your job, and you can have your insurance if you want, but it's going to cost you about $25,000 a year as opposed to whatever you were paying. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. I just love to pick your brain, Sean, because I wonder how all these things work. Sean Greminger, President and CEO of the National Alliance of Healthcare Purchasers Coalitions. If y'all have any questions, 504-260-1870. That's the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and Text line. I think I've already proved there are no dumb questions, and please no texting and driving. When we come back, we'll talk about the reasons why costs are on the rise, and does the One Big Beautiful Bill Act have anything to do with it? 923, Tommy Tucker, back in a flash, WWL. 928, if you're just tuning in, what we do is not really a traditional, you know, talk show, radio talk show with, I'll tell you what's wrong with this. We do more of like podcast stuff is what we do. And Sean Greminger is our guest, president and CEO of the National Alliance of Healthcare Purchasers Coalitions. Employee health insurance costs could jump in 2026. And we'll talk about why. I want to get to texter, if I text lines, if I can, though, real quick, Sean, and somebody texted in and said, you guys are making a unwitting case for universal health care. Well, I guess that's, I don't know if we are or not, but the question is, does the system work now, and is there a better way to do it? How do you judge results?
Yeah, it's a good, I mean, it's a good question. And, you know, universal health care, I mean, there is a case for it. There's also, you know, arguments against. But I do think it's worth saying, you know, the current system is not working well for people, right? Mm-hmm. It's people don't feel like they have access. We've got real areas of the country that have real problems with access, and particularly in the rural health space, which is something we should talk about. And even in, you know, in New Orleans or Baton Rouge or Shreveport, you know, the costs are just too high. And there's a lot that needs to be done about that. You could go all the way to the universal healthcare space, or there may be other sort of options that are a little bit less radical. But, you know, I think it's good to start from a perspective of like this current system isn't working for people.
Who is it working for?
Well, I'd say it's working well for large health insurance companies. There's no question about that. Most of the big health insurers post significant profits every year, and many of them make up some of the largest, you know, corporations in the world. Mm-hmm. United Health Group is truly one of the largest. I mean, it's the largest health insurer in the world, and it's one of the largest companies in the world. And I would argue it's working for at least some of the hospital systems. There's a real divide between the haves and have-nots in the hospital space. And it's something that people don't really realize. You know, your kind of small rural hospitals struggle mightily. That's why we see so many of them going out of business. You know, but there are large kind of corporate, theoretically not-for-profit systems that do really well. Their CEOs are making millions of dollars a year. They have enough money to buy other, you know, buy up physician practices. And, you know, it's not clear to me that they're really delivering the value that they should be, considering that they're tend to be making quite a bit of money.
So what I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong, is we might be moving toward universal health care, or maybe rather than universal health care, maybe so a single provider, what do they call it?
Single payer.
Single payer, but yeah. The single payer is going to be the corporation, the big insurance company that wins at the end. Yes or no?
Yeah, I think that's actually a really interesting way to think about it, and I think it's an astute thought. You know, I've kind of told folks when I've talked to health insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies and hospitals to say, look, the system we have right now, you know, you guys are getting richer, but people are getting more and more upset. And we've seen that, you know, across the board. Of course, everybody, you know, knows about the assassination of the UHD mm-hmm. CEO. People are really pretty upset. And I think, you know, unless we can find a way to make this system more sustainable, I would not be surprised if we ended up seeing a sort of radical reform back towards a more socialized healthcare system. But until then, you're right. I mean, I think, you know, arguably you could say, you know, we may get to single payer, but it's all going to be run by United Health Group based out of Minnetonka, Minnesota.
We always think it's about us. Talk about people in rural communities, would you, Sean, please?
Yeah. You know, it's there's been a lot of focus on rural health in the last couple of months, particularly, you know, with the passage of the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill. You know, there's been an argument that the bill legitimately does take about $1 trillion out of the Medicaid program in various different ways. And that's going to have, you know, really profound impacts. I'm not a, you know, sort of out there screaming and saying we've got to undo all those cuts, but there's no question that it's going to make it harder for rural hospitals and rural providers who are already struggling to keep their doors open. You know, as you know very well, rural communities tend to be older on average, so you've got more Medicare population. They tend to be poorer on average, so you've got a larger Medicaid population. And if we have less money flowing into those programs, that means that, you know, rural providers are going to struggle a lot. And that's something that I think we have to figure out as a, you know, as a society and as a healthcare system of how do we make sure that, you know, a person isn't having to drive 100 or 200 miles to be able to get access to healthcare.
I'm no Sean Greminger, and I'm no president and CEO of the National Alliance of Healthcare Purchaser Coalitions, but I do know, Sean, that you can only shove so much stuff into a pipe until it breaks and then goes spraying out all over everybody. Or if you don't look at it another way, maybe a more appropriate example in this case would be you if you got a sump pump that stops working, eventually it's going to overflow. And I'm just wondering, when it comes to Medicaid being cut, who does mm-hmm. that overflow onto?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. So, you know, there is an argument, and we're hearing hospitals sort of make this case to say, look, Right now, the one of the reasons they argue that we pay so much for commercial health insurance, so employers are paying or people who are purchasing their own insurance in the individual market are paying, is because they have to make up for Medicaid cuts, right? And they have to make up for Medicaid prices. Mm-hmm. On average, Medicaid does not pay hospitals very well. It certainly doesn't pay doctors very well. A lot of them still take Medicaid because it's the right thing to do, and it makes up a substantial portion of the population. But if fewer people have Medicaid or if the Medicaid payment rates are lower, the hospitals argue, look, I have to charge you, the employer, even more money than I was before. And so we're doing our best to try to fight back on that and say, look, it's not our fault that Medicaid underpays. And, you know, employers and employees can't afford to see another 15-20% premium increase. But, you know, I understand if I'm a hospital CEO, particularly in a rural area, I've got to figure out how to keep my doors open. And if the only way to do that is to raise prices, you know, for the 25% of my patients that are actually paying commercial insurance rates, I'm going to do that because, you know, I have a objective to continue to provide access. So there's no question that kind of the rest of us probably are paying more for health care than we otherwise would if Medicaid was reimbursed better.
So I had the privilege of working for a man, Ed Muniz. A lot of local people here know who he is, and he taught me, and I, you know, because of the way I was raised and grew up kind of poor, I never did think about that. But you got to think 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line. You can't think about tomorrow, and you can't think next year, right? You got to think 5 years mm-hmm. down the line, 10 years down the line. And as president and CEO of the National Alliance of Healthcare Purchaser Coalitions, you yourself know that. So if we're talking about 15, 20% this year and nothing changes, where do you see this 5, 10 years from now?
Yeah, this is something that I spent a lot of time thinking about and really trying to actually encourage the kind of the other stakeholders in the healthcare industry to say, like, you know, we use this term unsustainable all the time, mm-hmm. but we don't really think about what it means, right? What it means is truly there is a breaking point because mm-hmm. we cannot be sustained.
Going back to my tube example, right? My pipe. You can only shove so much stuff in a pipe, Sean.
That's absolutely right. So, you know, we've already started to see, you know, employers actually say, you know, we're not only are we going to ask our employees to pay more, which is not popular and, mm-hmm. and frankly isn't a great way to handle things, but starting to say, like, we're just not going to be able to afford health coverage anymore. That's particularly on the smaller business side of things, right? A large corporation, they can probably handle it. It's going to require some, you know, some working. But if you're a 20, 30, 50 person employer, you can't pay $25,000 a year for a family of one of your, you know, one of your employees. And so I think, you know, as prices continue to go up, you know, the countervailing pressure is employers just say, I can't offer this anymore. And now you're going to have more uninsured people. And then you get to this case of like, well, what happens then, right? If the uninsured rate in the United States goes up significantly, I do think there's going to be policymakers that sort of step in and say, we've got to fix this. And maybe they say, depending on what their political background is, maybe they say, we're going to fix it by, you know, instituting, you know, Medicare for all, or we're going to fix it by, you know, forcing employers to cover people. I mean, I just think that you're going to end up seeing policymakers feel like they have to do something to solve that problem.
I remember having the conversation, it was on the air 15 years ago and even before that, about, you know, with Obamacare and all of this. And it seemed to me at that time, it always broke along the lines of, if the healthcare system was working for you, you didn't want to change it. If it wasn't working for you, something needed to be done. And I remember giving people the example of, okay, you got your job today, and this goes back to what you and I were discussing before, Sean. You got your job today, and you got your insurance, and everything's good, and you think the system's fine. You don't want to touch it. Guess what? Tomorrow you lose your job. You're uh-huh. faced with COBRA and paying these exorbitant rates, or hoping for Medicaid, or how do you feel about it then? So I don't know where the will comes from to change this, do you?
No, I mean, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, it's I worked on Obamacare. Mm-hmm. I was a lobbyist in D.C., and it was a law that I knew pretty well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the promise at the time was that it was going to do two things. Is, you know, it was under the title of it was the Affordable Care Act. And the promise was, hey, we're gonna cover more people who were previously uninsured, and then they did that pretty successfully, right? A lot of people got added to Medicaid. They set up the individual market, so more people were able to purchase health insurance through what they call the exchange or the marketplace. So that worked. But the other promise was, we're gonna change policies so that the price of healthcare goes down, right? And on that measure, it was a total failure. And I think what we're seeing is we're now, you know, what is it, 15 years, mm-hmm. you know, past the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, and, you know, half the bill worked and half the bill failed, and that failure is sort of coming up to, is coming back to bite us. And, you know, I think we have to have a serious conversation about what is the next thing that's going to actually solve the affordability problem.
Nobody wanted anything changed. However, they didn't gripe about kids being able to stay in a policy until 26, about no upper limits, and about no being turned down for pre-existing conditions, right?
That's right. And there were certainly parts of it that, you know, it's funny, as you probably remember, you know, Obamacare was really unpopular for mm-hmm. actually several years. It cost Democrats some elections. But then it was actually when Republicans in Congress came in to try to repeal it that people kind of look back and they're like, oh, wait a minute. There's a couple things in here that I like.
Right. Let's not lose our heads. Sean, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, sir. I hope we talk to you again. Sean Greminger, President and CEO of the National Alliance of Healthcare Purchaser Coalitions. Get ready, because I don't know when your benefit selection process happens. I think we choose in August, if I remember correctly, or September, and then it goes into effect the following year. So I think it is coming up. Anyway, it's going up. Get ready. And then next year, guess what? It's going to go up again. We come back, we'll talk to Dr. Fred Lopez about this Vibrio, whatever it is, virus bacteria that's spreading through salt water and raw shellfish. Right now, we pause for traffic on WWL. 9:47, 13 till 10. All right, we're thinking it. Tommy Tucker, WWL. I'll go ahead and say it just when you thought it was safe to go into the water. Dr. Fred Lopez joins us, professor of medicine in the section of infectious diseases at LSU Health New Orleans. Good morning, Dr. Fred. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy.
Let's talk about, well, I don't know what we're talking about. Vulnificus? How do you say it?
Yeah, Vibrio vulnificus is the name of the bacteria that's been getting so much press recently.
When you say so much press, rightfully so or not?
Yeah, I think it's important. This is the time of the year when we tend to see infections caused by this bacteria. It's a bacteria that's in the same family as Vibrio cholera, but it can cause really severe infection. For healthy people, usually it's a diarrheal illness that's self-limited if they get infected with this bacteria. But for people with certain risk factors, liver disease, cancer, diabetes, people taking steroids, for people who have stomach acid-reducing medications that they're taking, for these individuals, they can develop severe infections, usually of two types. One is after consumption of raw shellfish that come from the waters that are colonized with this bacteria. It can get into their bloodstream and even cause sepsis, meaning low blood pressure, fever, but sometimes even death in about half of patients who develop this infection. The other type of infection is a wound infection. So somebody, particularly with one of these immunocompromising conditions, has an open wound. They go into brackish waters or Gulf of Mexico waters, and all of a sudden they get a wound infection. And particularly if they have one of those immunocompromising conditions, that bacteria can cause a skin infection that's very invasive and potentially even get into the bloodstream. And there, the mortality rate is around 20%. So very significant mortality rates associated with these severe infections, particularly in people with these risk factors for more severe illness.
I don't want to hurt myself here, Dr. Fred, but let me go out on a limb. It's bacteria. It's not virus, so it can be treated with an antibiotic or not?
Yes, it can be treated with an antibiotic. It needs to be considered and treated as early as possible because it can progress really, really quickly. Usually when it causes those wound infections, we need to do surgery. Sometimes even amputation is required in order to control the infection while we give the antibiotics. The same is true when it gets into the bloodstream. We need to start antibiotics as quickly as possible. And those patients with who develop the bloodstream infections, they can also get these skin lesions, and sometimes they require surgery as well. So it means recognizing it early, starting antibiotics, and potentially life-saving surgeries in order to stem the progression of this infection.
Yeah, Florida seems to be the hotbed for this, and I guess I'm wondering, there are so many people from here that go to Florida during the summer. How long does it take to manifest itself, and Tell me again how you would know you have this?
Well, it's only usually from the time of exposure people can start to develop manifestations of illness within a couple of days.
Okay.
And so if a wound gets inflamed, and particularly if the skin changes color, you need to worry about this illness. A lot of people will also have watery diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, fever, chills. And if you've been exposed to the bacteria, meaning you've gotten in the Gulf coastal waters, for example, or have eaten recently undercooked shellfish or raw shellfish, particularly oysters, and you develop these kinds of symptoms, you really need to reach out to your healthcare provider. And, you know, you mentioned Florida. Mm. You know, they've had quite a few cases. I believe the last time I looked at the data, they've had about 13 cases. Mm. And 4 deaths. But Louisiana last week reported 17 cases and 4 deaths. So 32 cases, in fact, have been reported from the Gulf coastal states. But it appears that Louisiana is leading in the number of cases of infection caused by this bacteria.
Is there a way to tell if it's from the Louisiana waters, Doc, or from where people
are? It's basically, this is not a pollutant or a contaminant in the Gulf coastal waters, Lake Pontchartrain, Lake Maurepas, brackish waters, coastal waters. They're going to contain this organism in the summer months. Mm. Not a pollutant, natural inhabitant. All it needs is low amounts of salt and a temperature greater than 68 degrees Fahrenheit, and all of a sudden you've got a nice little culture dish for this bacteria. So if you're getting into the waters in the Gulf off the Gulf Coast, you're being exposed to this organism. If you're eating raw shellfish from off the Gulf Coast, you're being exposed to this bacteria. And if you have those risk factors I mentioned earlier, you should avoid getting in those waters, and you should definitely avoid eating undercooked or raw shellfish.
So what kills...
It's not a Gulf Coast issue anymore, by the way. Chesapeake Bay, Delaware Bay has been reporting infections caused by this bacteria, likely due to global warming and increased sea surface temperatures.
So does the cold weather kill it?
It doesn't thrive when the water temperatures are less than 68 degrees Fahrenheit. But the waters have been greater than 68 degrees Fahrenheit for months. Usually this is in April through October. Phenomenon when we see these infections, but with global warming, you can say that once the waters get above the 68 degrees Fahrenheit, we're going to find that bacteria in the water.
And I don't get anybody mad at me, but would you say don't eat raw oysters now?
I think if you're immune compromised by those conditions I mentioned earlier, particularly liver disease, I would avoid raw oysters. I would avoid getting in the waters that contain this organism during the warm summer months.
Thank you, Doc. Appreciate it. Dr. Fred Lopez, our friend, professor, medicine section of infectious diseases at LSU Health New Orleans. We'll take a break. Then we come back. We'll talk with Newell Norman, see what he's got planned for us today on WWL. 9:58, just like that, we've blown through Monday morning. Newell Norman joins us now. Newell, it amazes me looking at the Okunard Jeweler talk and text line. Half of the people think I have Trump derangement syndrome, and half of the people think that I'm in Trump's camp. So I guess I'm doing the right thing? I don't know. Makes sense?
Yeah.
I guess.
Your identity lasts as long as your last statement.
I get it.
Right?
Pretty much. I think that's it, Newell, as a matter of fact. As much as your last statement. How you been? How was your weekend? Nice?
I don't know. I forgot what my last statement was.
I hope you got in that pool this weekend, because it was hot.
It was hot. Went out to White Linen Night. Had a great time out there. A big turnout, which is good to see.
Yeah, I'm more of a blue polyester kind of guy.
Blue polyester guy.
Yeah, not white linen,
absolutely.
Blue polyester. What you got coming up today?
Hangover from the disco days, right?
There you go. That's right.
We got a great show. We'll visit with Guy Williams. We'll talk about the case for and against a Fed rate cut. We'll talk about more troubles for the auto industry here in the U.S. of A. Some more fraud schemes. Very interesting. FedEx and package delays, fake credit bureau settlements, gift card offers, a lot going on. We'll talk about all of that and more.